April 28th. We have our agenda in front of us, just some minor adjustments. We'll start the work session, and then we'll have House Bill 3403 first, and then unless there's some other needed changes, we'll continue on down the list. The first item up is work session on House Bill 3465.
Yes, sir.
Open the work session on House Bill 3465.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3465 to the floor with a due process recommendation.
Pardon me just a moment. Before we get to that, we can have some minor amendments, and then we have been instructed it needs to go to Ways and Means. So thank you. We appreciate you want
to move this thing along
and get ready. Janet?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3465, you, at the last meeting, you had the dash 2 amendments, and now there are the dash 3 amendments. They are the same. They create an interim task force to study the issues related to an intergovernmental road maintenance entity between counties and the Department of Transportation. The change in the dash 3 is that they delete a provision allowing compensation and expenses for non-legislative members of the task force.
Okay. Chairman, I move the dash 3 amendment.
Okay. We have a motion to move the dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3465. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we have the dash 3 amendments. If I may, before you move, we have the three gentlemen who have been working very hard on it. The representatives, would you like to comment on anything? Are you all three in agreement that these, I see three things. Brad, let the record show there were three thumbs up. Thank you very much, Representative Layman.
Mr. Chairman, I think this bill is now okay with Representative Wells. I move this forward to the Ways and Means for due pass recommendations.
Representative Layman moves House Bill 3465 as amended to Ways and Means of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Cron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only comment is that I would have been very willing to vote for this bill in its original form. I think that continuing to study is the bane of our government, and I think that we need to move on with some of these things.
Thank you. I appreciate your concern, and that's why it's going to Ways and Means, Representative Cron, instead of the floor. Thank you. Are there any other discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Hi. House Bill 3465 is moved to Ways and Means. Thank you, three, for working very hard and everyone else who works with you. Good cooperation does work. And on its way to Ways and Means. The next bill we will hear will be House Bill 3403. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3403. With Representative Sherry and Janet, could you give us a rundown on that one, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that House Bill 3403 would require the Department of Transportation to contract with an agent to monitor compliance with financial responsibility requirements. Whenever you see financial responsibility in motor vehicle law, it means liability insurance. And also requires the DMV to provide the contractor with information that they receive under state law from insurance companies. Requires the agent to identify vehicles that have been uninsured for 3 consecutive months and to notify owners that they are subject to driver license suspension. It requires owners that are so notified by the agent, the contracted agent, that they have 45 days to either prove they have insurance, to prove an exemption from insurance, or to show that they are not no longer the owner of the vehicle. DMV would then be required to suspend the driving privileges of owners who fail to respond. The bill requires 2 bids in order for the department to contract the service and appropriate. The original bill appropriated a certain amount of money in the amendments, the dash 1 amendment amount is blank. Anyway, that it needs a general fund appropriation for the implementation of the bill.
So this would have a referral to Ways and Means. And,
yes, Mr. Chair, they have a referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. May I have a representative from Sherry? Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the Houston and Senate time, I'll proceed. For the record, my name is Ron Duhatter.
Good senator from across the aisle on the other end of the building. Good morning, Senator.
Morning, Supreme Being.
9:30. Excuse me. Would you like to start over?
Okay.
Yeah, you may go first. I have a tie symbol to that. Mine has a black sheep in the middle of it.
I have many black sheep.
Thank you, Ron. Please go ahead. For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Ron Sinceri. I'm the state representative of District 22. Last year, DOV estimated the number of uninsured motorists to be around 13%. That's just based on sampling of accidents. The insurance industry puts it more, about 15 to 20%. We just don't have a complete database, so we really don't know what the percentage is, but it's probably more than that. I'm sure all the members of this committee have had contact with members or constituents in your districts where there's been this problem. It's rampant. This bill is patterned after a bill that was done in Colorado with great success. And just to cut my testimony short, Mr. Chair, I'd like to direct the attention of the committee to the top of the bill. This really has bipartisan support. It's an issue that affects us all, and it's not an issue that's going away in Oregon, but it's getting worse. So I just recommend that the committee look at this carefully, and it's something that we can do to really help the uninsured motorists, and I think the plan that was outlined by the administrator could really be important.
Thank you. We have some Dash 1 amendments before, so I might have missed what you've come. Have you seen these, and they are yours? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Will. Thank you. Has there been any dollar figure put on this? What's going to cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, we asked about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago for the fiscal impact, and I've not received it or seen it. If the administrator has a copy of that, I've not seen it.
I see the ODOT back here, and I imagine they're signed up to testify. We don't have a number before. So
are we going to have this number, or are we just going to move it away from the...
No. We don't have a number. We're not moving anything. So a number, or an approximate number anyhow.
So say that, Mr. Chair, you know, of course, I'm signed on to this bill, so it must be a good one.
That was a question, Representative.
But anyway, I was looking at my insurance policy this weekend, and I noticed I pay $30 every 6 months extra to cover uninsured motorists, accidents with uninsured motorists. So there certainly is a cost shift here in this whole issue to us who do pay insurance. And I think whatever we can do is good. So I guess it kind of boils down to, you know, what's it going to cost is an issue here. We always have to weigh in these kind of things.
Mr. Chair, Wells, I agree with that, and I think it's time that we spend some money to do this. I mean, we have, at least from the 3 terms I've been here, we've had it around trying to figure out some way to do this and afraid of money, and it's a growing problem, and it's a serious problem. We don't think about it much unless we're involved in something like that, and it really is a serious problem. So it's time for the legislature to spend some money to make this go away.
One more comment. As I understand the issue, we suspend the driver's license, but does that really keep people from driving this day and age? Because it was interesting looking at the senior driving issue the other day, which we had that bill here, that some seniors are afraid to go back and be tested because maybe they can't get a new license, so they just drive without a license. I think we have a lot of people then that just continue to drive, so I don't know whether suspension gets to the issue or not.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to be guilty of talking the committee out of this bill, so I'll be really brief. But this also provides for fines as a result of being notified through this computer database. There are other criminal penalties for people who are caught now without driving with a suspended license that have been stepped up from what we have seen in the past. So.
Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if you are the appropriate person to ask this question to, but it doesn't explain in the bill how the designated agent is contracted with. And I sort of want to know a little more information about that. Perhaps that's an ODOT question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, probably ODOT, and then Mr. Egan will also probably be able to explain that to you. Work carefully in bringing this from Idaho, or from Colorado, the Colorado bill, and crafting it within ours. So.
So then to the committee, we have 3 people signed up. ODOT will be the last one we hear from, and then we can ask them some questions. We'll be happy to call them up here earlier to have them questions. Thank you. Senator Courtney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to call them where you are. If you have a tap hearing on this, so this is the official public hearing on the bill, I believe. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senate District 17, which is Salem Kaiser, and this bill, the follow-up work that I began in 1993, I had forgotten I'd done it in 1993, which may mean I've got some medical problems, but I forgot that I introduced legislation aimed at reducing the number of uninsured motorists by using technology to help us determine which drivers were uninsured. A Senate version of my bill passed, and the governor signed it. But that bill just required that a database be created which would provide information on which Oregon vehicles were uninsured so that when a law enforcement person would then have access to it when they made a stop, they stopped the vehicle, they could tell that they were uninsured. That's all it did. The bill was simple, not sexually. It was just a database. This bill goes much further. It says that we're very serious, that we want all Oregon drivers to contribute to the insurance pool, and if you own a car and it's not insured, we're going to find out about it. And when we find out about it, we'll give you a chance, which is 45 days to get your insurance. If you don't, we can suspend your license. And I guess what it simply points out is, I'm reading the bill before I came down here, making notes and lines and outlining things. I guess that's the lawyer in me, that, look, if you don't have insurance for 3 consecutive months, you're in deep trouble. You're going to get noticed if you don't have insurance. Then they find, you better make a move within 45 days, and they're going to suspend it. Now, I don't think money should be an issue, and I don't think, I was listening to the Q&A that's been going on here with Tennessee Surrey, representing Surrey in the committee, and I don't think the fact that some people drive when they don't have a license should be an issue. Being on the Judiciary Committee, we run into this all the time because we are dramatically looking at the DUII laws and things like that, and I can tell you right here now, if there's a group of people out there, I don't care if you take away a license. Unless you put them in jail, if they get near a car, they're going to use it. That's the burden our society has to live with, and that's just the way it is. Whether you suspend their license, whether they've got 4 DUIs, short of putting them in jail, if they can get a friend's car, whatever, they're going to drive. What's so important about this is, I can't tell you the number of constituents that are upset about the fact that there's the one thing about DUII bothers them. There's no question about that. Road rage is starting to bother people more and more in our society, but uninsured motorists is something that I have been badged about in my 7th, now my 8th term in the Oregon legislature. So I think anything we can do that will force the issue or cherish or stick the issue to get some of the 13%, which is the figure that Representative Sherry used, down to maybe single digits to get insurance, we should do. And this bill does that because it's proactive, not reactive. All my bill did back in 93 was have the database, so that when the state police stop somebody or a county or city, they come back and say you're uninsured. This goes further. This says you got a notice and you better get your act together. So I think it's a very good bill, and I hope you will favorably consider it.
Mr. Senator, you have some questions? Thank you both for coming in this morning. Appreciate you taking the time. Mm-hmm. Next on our list is Pat Egan. And Pat, you may have some people who'd like to join you or
yeah.
Come up by yourself, whichever you take.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Egan, and I'm here today on behalf of Explorer Information Services. Explorer is a company that is a data management company that manages a program similar to the one we proposed for the Colorado Motor Vehicles Division, MVD, there in Colorado. Essentially, the Colorado model includes, and you have my written comments, so I'll just go through them in outline form. Essentially, the Colorado model starts where Oregon has started, and that is to create a database and builds on that by providing notice to the individuals that the database identifies as being uninsured. There are similar programs in the state of Illinois and Florida that have effectively reduced the uninsured motorist rate. In the case of Florida, and you have in the supplemental packet with you an excerpt from a Florida report from the Florida Senate that shows the uninsurance rate there is reduced to by about half. Explorer won the contract, and I think we can get into some of the questions you asked for Senator Walker about what would happen, I think, here in Oregon. But Explorer won the contract in competition with 10 other companies in the state of Colorado. And as to the dollars in Colorado, the initial appropriation from the Colorado legislature was $3 million. Explorer was able to do their initial part of it for roughly $1.5 million, and that's to monitor about 4 million vehicles. And in Oregon, we believe that would be less. The essential elements of the Colorado program include the building of the database, which is already that's already in statute, and DMV is already well on the way, I think, getting that started. Once the database has been created, you can identify the you can identify those uninsured motorists, and are able to send them a letter. If 90 days have passed, you send them a letter, and you have a copy of the Colorado letter. It's a non-threatening letter that basically notifies the individual that proof of insurance is required in order to operate the vehicle. So within 45 days, you have to reply. If you don't reply, then the process goes into place for revocation of the license and for the fine. And there are plenty of notice steps along the way. There's an appeals process along the way. The bulk of the amendments before you deal with the repeal of the random sampling statute and the deletion of the random sampling requirement, and inserts into the process the process for revoking the license and
appeals. You mentioned both of the amendments. Do you have another amendment?
Or did I say both? I'm sorry, that's one amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Excuse me. In closing, the passage of Council 3403, excuse me, we believe would send a message, and that's, that gets to the enforcement. Right now, the only enforcement, really, of the financial responsibility requirements are if you get stopped by police when you're registering your vehicle, or potentially if you get into an accident and it's discovered that you're uninsured. 3403 would provide a mechanism for providing notice to an individual that's uninsured that they should, in fact, be insured. Thank you for the opportunity to present the legislation, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, sir. Yes, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Egan, I see by the letter to the Colorado Motorist that the license plate will be subject to seizure. Is this the same?
We dropped that from our request here for a couple of reasons. One, we feel that the enforcement here would be enough for revocation of the driver's license and fine. In Colorado, I'm not sure as to whether the police are actually going out and pulling the driver's or the license plate.
So if you take away the driver's license of the owner of the car, that doesn't mean that other persons in the family with driver's license, operable that driver's license, wouldn't be driving, continue to drive.
The vehicle is uninsured. Mm-hmm. That is true. The owner is the owner of the vehicle is the person who would receive the letter. It would still be illegal and subject to a fine to operate the vehicle.
Yes, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's an intriguing thing. Maybe you don't want to go there, but why wouldn't we move to grab a license plate? Because that would be a practical expression that the vehicle is uninsured and would draw attention to it during law enforcement versus revoking someone's driver's license. You know, you don't know.
Sure.
They are. I don't know in terms of how Colorado law is that relates to license plates and those kinds of things, but it would seem to be a little more way to have it and make sure that people actually have insurance. So versus the driver's license, which would all be generated, by computers and mailed every day, and we'd all feel good about it. But a more practical expression of the fact that if you don't have insurance on that vehicle, you won't have any license plate, and therefore it'll be a little harder for you to traverse the community.
I would agree. I think that that's a policy choice that that you all could make, certainly. I think it's also an issue for some in law enforcement whether they want to go out and actually take the screwdriver and pull the plate off. So I think you might want to hear from them as to the practicalities there. Certainly, I think you're right. It would definitely be an indication, because right now, a vehicle going down the road, you don't know whether it's insured or not. Although, when the database is completed, it's already going to be made available to law enforcement. So hopefully, they'll either have through dispatch or through their in-car computer
the ability to type in the license plate and determine whether it's insured. But right, that's another step.
That's what the extent in terms of the data and the database is correct.
Correct.
And the frequency that insurance companies are updating the data. But from the point of if you seize a license plate, I think that is a little bit more onerous to someone to say that if they are found out that their license plates are going to be taken off the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I understand there's some practical issues there. But in terms of, I think that fear factor is going to be a little bit greater than, you still are walking around with a driver's license in your hand. Nobody comes and seizes a driver's license.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I have to concur with my colleague from Beaverton, or Hillsboro, excuse me, if I'm taking it correctly. I fully agree, short of confiscating someone's automobile, which I don't think we need to do necessarily in this case, although I think maybe under other circumstances that might be wholly appropriate, such as repeat offenders of DUI. In this case, I think pulling a license plate is very appropriate. Who's going to drive down the road without a license plate? I mean, think about it. It makes perfect sense. He just brings up an excellent point. I wish you'd leave that in the bill. Frankly, I'd be more in favor to add it back in. I think it puts teeth in this thing.
Well, we would be happy to.
I think they would want it. Pardon me, go ahead.
Sure. Well, we would be happy to consider that and to work with agencies if necessary to figure out what would be the most practical manner to achieve this.
The committee, there's not much time to work on this bill, and we might be working on it for another 10 minutes, and then we'll move on to another one. So if we want to make some changes.
Well, Mr. Sheraton, can they fix it in 3 minutes?
Well, it's going from here to Ways and Means, probably, most likely, because it has a financial
assessment.
So, it'll be referred down there. In fact, to answer questions, of course they can.
All right.
So we could do that here with a conceptual amendment if the committee wanted to. Here, so.
No, I'm in favor of that, conceptually.
Just take about a couple minutes. I won't do it. Representative Connell, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. On the hand engrossed version that we have, at the bottom of the first page, section 3, line 27, it says, three consecutive months shall submit to the agent within 45 days of mailing of the notice from the agent one of the following. But then if you fast forward to page 2B, I guess, which is page 2 of the dash 1s under section 13,
mm-hmm.
And I don't have a line number, I'm sorry, but it says 806.160 of the Department of Transportation should demand that a person provide the department within 30 days after the date of the mailing of the demand, satisfactory proof that the person is in compliance with financial responsibility requirements with as of the date. I see that as a conflict. I don't know if it is. Maybe you can explain if it's not a conflict.
That's a good question. I think what you're seeing there is once the letter's been sent out, the person has 45 days to respond. I believe once those 45 days have expired, then the department's implementation part goes into effect. Explorer, whatever company wins the contract, sends notice back to the Department of Transportation that this person has, in fact, not replied to the letter, and then the department's process goes into place. And the 30 days you're seeing there right now is the current statute as it relates to random sampling. Right now, the department is required to send out certain random sampling letters. If you get it, you're going to respond. You've already got an insurance policy. If someone who's uninsured gets it, they may not respond. If they don't respond, then this 30 days goes into effect. We just took those provisions and adopted them for our proposal.
President Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Egan, I haven't heard from your gentleman since the company. But how many companies are there like this in the United States? Are there a significant number for us to choose from?
I'll answer briefly and then turn it over to them. My knowledge is that for the Colorado project, they have similar language on requesting RFPs from other companies, and I believe they had 10 bidders on it. But I can turn it over to Phil or Jim for that.
For the record, would you mind mentioning your
name? My name is Philip Casey. I'm General Manager of Explorer Information Services. There are minimally 30 to 40 companies that could provide this kind of service, and probably more than that.
thank you. Representative Mulkey,
Yeah, I'm glad.
Thank you. I guess I'd like to hear from you. You're in this business. We're talking about timelines here, certain amount of days to respond. As I understand, you can buy insurance. You can buy it today and cancel it tomorrow. So how do you handle that kind of situation, making sure people are still insured? I could go out and buy insurance and then call it 10 days later and cancel.
That's the beauty of the database approach, in that companies in the Colorado sector are required to notify us of cancellation or failure to pay premium. I believe it's within 7 days. So that there would be a window where the database would be not current, potentially 7 days. But most insurance companies, especially the larger ones, are updating their data every week. There's a requirement in the Colorado statute that it's minimally monthly, but as you might imagine, most larger companies are more sophisticated and they're able to update their information more frequently.
I guess a follow-up on that, Mr. Chair. Seems like the timelines are awful long in here, though. You're allowing 30 days and 45 days. Why are those timelines so long for people to respond? Because you don't have that kind of response right now under current statutes. If you don't have proof of insurance, you get stopped over here in Kaiser, they'll tow your car. I mean, there's no timeline there. Boom, it's gone.
Right. Principally, the thought process of 3 consecutive months is... you have a lot of people that change their insurance companies, so to allow, if that takes place, to allow the lead lag effect to be compensated for. As far as the 45 days, principally that's in there to allow for vehicle transactions, buying and selling vehicles, in that or at least it appears that people are much more conscientious about when they buy a new vehicle, as far as getting insurance, they're a little slow as far as registering their vehicle. So there's some lead lag effect associated with the temporary plates which dealers issue with new vehicles, and that's principally the thought process behind the 45 days.
That's very good.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Knowing the limitations the chair has put on consideration of these bills, I would... and being a co-sponsor of the bill, I would hope we'd move on to the Department of Transportation and take action on this.
Thank you. I'd like to have them come up also. Representative Lehman has a question. Maybe you have some other comments, too. Representative Lehman?
If I understand it, in the state of Oregon, can I have a driver's license and no insurance as long as I don't drive a car?
I believe as long as the vehicle itself is insured. If that's your question, Representative Lehman, I believe that if the vehicle itself is insured and you're a licensed driver, you can operate that vehicle with the permission of the owner of the car.
Am I reading this correctly that if I have insurance and my insurance is canceled, you suspend my driver's license?
No. Could you repeat the question?
If I have a Oregon driver's license, and I'm insured, and then I cancel my insurance, unless I don't drive, I just quit driving. Does this allow you then to come back and suspend my driver's license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, I believe what the records are checked against are the vehicle identification of the vehicle itself. So if you own a vehicle that is not insured, you cancel your insurance, you will have an opportunity to say that you're not operating that vehicle. So in that scenario, I don't believe your license would be revoked.
Okay, we do need to move along. I have one question here, and Janet didn't want to ask it, but she gave me a note. No, I'll ask it.
Okay,
about that. The people may have a car registered but not drive it for all or part of the year. How are these people handled? Do every 3 months will they get a letter or something to notify them? Is that anticipated way? I'm sure your pickup truck for half a year because you don't drive it in the wintertime or something like that.
Right, Mr. Chair. I believe that would be, right now, if that same person were to get a random sampling letter and were to ask to respond whether their vehicle was insured, I believe that they would have the ability to say that they're not operating the vehicle. statute as it's written is you get a citation for failure to comply with financial responsibility requirements for operating a vehicle. So if you were to provide, I think, evidence that you're not operating the vehicle and that it was in storage, for example, or something like that, or you're on extended vacation, then I think you would be fine.
Well, thank you. Well, we'll go on to Kelly Taylor, if you don't, unless you all go and have something else to say. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Kelly, would you come forward, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. And I won't read my testimony. I'll just walk through. I would like to respond to a couple of questions I've heard, if that's all right. Representative Hill, you were asking about taking license plates and things. It is true that, and Representative Wells mentioned this, on the books today, besides things like, you know, issuing a citation and checking accident reports and a random sample, law enforcement, if you're driving a car that's uninsured, can impound that car, can take it. And that's not a forfeiture, it's an impoundment. That's different. There's a whole different process associated. But they can tow the car right then and there. So that's on the books today and has been since last session. It was, you know, just the Portland area to begin with, and then it got expanded. There was a bill or a law several sessions ago, I think around 91 or so, called the zebra sticker law. And under certain circumstances, police would put actually a zebra sticker, little striped sticker, over the tag on your plate and cancel your registration right that second and give you, you know, notice of, you know, pending suspension and things like that. I don't really remember the law a whole bunch. That law was repealed a couple of years later because it was expensive and it wasn't really getting at what they hoped it would. It was with the sunset, and they let the sunset go. So just wanted to bring you up to date on a little bit of history that I knew that pertained to what you're asking. I'll get down to the expenditures. It does have a pretty hefty price tag. In the first biennium, it's over $1 million. In the second biennium, it's close to $1 million, and it would require an additional 12 positions. That's for handling the phone calls, the inquiry field offices, the letters, the suspensions, the hearings. Yeah. The revenue that's estimated to come in does not cover the expenditures. The revenue would be from reinstatement fees, people who got suspended and later subsequently got reinstated. The revenue's at about $250,000 in both bienniums, just roughly. There's a couple of issues that we'd like you to consider should you decide to move forward on this bill. It appears that the major policy thrust of the bill is to suspend driver's licenses of those individuals whose insurance company has notified DMV that their insurance has been terminated. And mind you, it will be all registered owners on that vehicle will become suspended.
Repeat that, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker. All registered owners, if there's three people registered as owners of the vehicle, all of them will have their driver's license suspended. The bill proposes to carry this new policy through a contract with an outside agent. And we would prefer to have the option to look at the most cost-effective approach to implement the policy decision should you decide to make that. We would suggest the bill be amended to give the department the flexibility to implement this in the most workable system. We do not know. It's true over the last few years, the sampling that we've done, which is a statistically valid sample of the accident report, there is somewhere between 11 and 13%, it kind of goes up and down different years, of motorists that are uninsured. There will always be some percentage, Senator Courtney is right, of the driving population that does not intend to buy insurance regardless of the penalties you put in place. Some people just flat out aren't going to buy insurance for a variety of reasons. It's unclear what the goal is for Oregon's uninsured rate. I don't know what you're trying to drive it down to, and I don't know whether I could say that this bill would actually get it there. And lastly, the bill does not address exactly who is responsible for paying the agent for the proposed compliance services, nor how much those services will cost in addition to the cost I've already told you about. I'm presuming, you know, there's a contract and perhaps it's a state. I do not know what those costs will be. That's not part of the fiscal as I put it together at this point. That would conclude my comments. I'd appreciate the committee's consideration of the issues and proposed amendments.
We'll take about two or three brief questions, then we will either go into work session or make some other decision. Representative Lehman?
Kelly, let me see if I understand this. If I have a vehicle that's insured and that vehicle breaks down, so I park it, I leave it registered, the insurance lapses. Is it my understanding then I would get a notice, if this were to pass, I would get a notice that my driver's license is being suspended because I no longer have insurance on a vehicle in my name?
Mr. Chair, representing, yes, you could receive that letter.
I see under issues to consider that you are frustrating the contract with an outside agent. It would seem to me that we're talking about hiring people if it's done inside and also putting in a new data system, or at least, you know, adding to what you have. With using an outside agency, they're set up to do it to go quickly, and I think I would certainly see that as a good way to go and to consider very highly.
Mr. Chairman Volkin, I don't disagree. I mean, you passed the bill last session that gives us the authority to be able to do some privatization efforts, and of course the privatization study made some recommendations on when that makes sense and when it doesn't, where you can get, you know, expanded services. And I'm not disagreeing. Jan's only comment is that there may be a more workable system, a more cost-effective approach, and that's her only concern.
Just to follow up, on the bill last system, I still have not seen the full report on that, on the cost for privatization. So to compare it with this, I don't think it's germane.
Thank you, Representative Stormwell, and then Devlin, and then we'll do something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up with Representative Lehman's question. As you read the bill, Kelly, or as you had it interpreted by the legal staff, is there a remedy to so that if a person owns a vehicle, doesn't insure it, gets the notice that they're going to have their license suspended, as you suggested in the answer to Representative Lehman, what's the remedy for the person? Is there a way in the bill that they're going to be able to show proof that they're not driving the vehicle and therefore shouldn't have their license suspended?
Mr. Chair, Representative Trumbull, I'm not sure the bill itself talks about it. You probably would need to put some sort of process in place that allows the person to tell us that, or tell the agent that the car is not working for a certain period of time. I don't know whether the agent will build that in their database to check back later on or whatever. But it is possible that the person would get a notice and have to do something, show up at a hearing or send a letter back or show some sort of documentation that the car is off the road at the time. But I don't know what will happen if they'll get subsequent letters, because later on it still looks some other period of time. That I don't know.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was my expectation in the earlier testimony, and I think it was accurate that people would be sent notices and that they would be allowed to respond as to why they did not have insurance.
Right.
The second issue that's brought in terms of the relationship between a vendor that was selected by the state and insurance companies that were utilizing the data. Couldn't that be addressed in the RFP itself, because ultimately if this passes, you'll be issuing an RFP, and within that RFP you might, you know, determine how fees are going to be charged and actually to what extent the state might share in the revenues from those fees.
Mr. Chairman, I'm honestly not very familiar with the RFP process, so I don't know what could or could not be in there, to be honest with you.
The figures you mentioned, the $1 million, does that include the cost of the contract? Somebody doing that to work outside?
Mr. Chair, no, it does not.
If there's no further questions, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3403. We can go into work session. We have a Dashlin amendment. If any stuff has some things we want to talk about, we will go into work session if the committee would like. We will not stay there longer than 5 minutes maximum. We have three other very important bills. I won't extend no more than 30 minutes to any of them. We're in work session on House Bill 3403. What's the pledge of the committee? Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dashlin amendments to the bill.
Representative Devlin moves the Dashlin amendments to House Bill 3403. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Hearing none, Dashlin amendments to House Bill 3403 have been included.
Any Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Devlin, House Bill 3403 as amended to Ways and Means with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Trustee Crummell and Rippey Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am concerned about the remedy to correct based on the questions that Representative Lehman had brought out. I think there's a couple of other things that maybe could be done to amend the bill, and I would hope that those amendments could be taken care of down in Ways and Means. I know that they generally like to just look at the dollars, but they can also do the substantive changes. And I think that it's important that we have some direction from the legislature in the legislation with regards to what kind of remedies the people have. I think probably everyone in this room at one time or another has had a situation where they've owned a vehicle and hasn't been insured for whatever reason because they're not driving it or it's under repair or whatever the case may be. With that said, I will support the bill, but if it comes to the floor and the remedy has not been put in place or some kind of direction, then I would reserve the right to vote no on the floor.
If they were voting on the House Bill 3403 as amended, sends it to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, which implies you like the bill. So, what I'm commenting on. Reverend Walker?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no vote on this bill because it is a due pass recommendation. I have lots of questions, but I think the fiscal impact is huge. I also am very, very concerned that anyone on the registration list all have their driver's license suspended. I think that's totally inappropriate. It should only be the driver who is driving the vehicle. I have concerns about that Representative Crummell has raised. My son, for instance, has a vehicle that's parked under the carport, and it's been there for almost 2 years because he uses his bicycle. And I don't want him harassed. He has a driver's license. He drives our vehicle. He's insured to drive our vehicle. So the department is concerned about the cost. They may be able to do it cheaper than through this agent. So I understand that this is what they're trying to do here, but I don't know. I haven't been convinced.
Thank you. For further discussion, Representative Devlin, are you interested in rewording your motion?
Mr. Chairman, if the chair believes that this may have a constitutional problem, I will change my motion to without recommendation.
That's on the way. Probably be a better way to get it down the Ways and Means.
Okay.
Representative.
I will do that.
Is there any discussion of that motion? Representative Devlin has withdrawn his previous motion. His new motion is to move House Bill 3403 as amended to Ways and Means
without recommendation.
Representative Crumpton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also would like to say that I support this concept. I do have, I share the concerns of both Representative Walker from Eugene and my good friends from Wilsonville in some respects. I think we need to look at privatization. I think this is a good opportunity to move forward with this process. I'd like to see, however, I think that someone needs to add some language into this at some point in time. I'm not going to do it here today. That deals with a vehicle and removing a license plate. Nobody's if your son's car is parked under your carport for 2 years, nobody's going to risk driving that thing down the road that doesn't have plate on it physically. I've got a van that I don't insure for most of the year, and I don't drive it. And I think it'd be fine to take the plate off. Suspending someone's license, I agree. I don't think is the way to do this. I think we need to flat remove the plates. I think that needs to be addressed at some point in time. I'll vote to move this thing forward, and we'll go from there.
Okay, and we'll ask Janet to contact our counterparts down on the front of our opinion. There's no further discussion. Will the clerk call the roll? We have before us House Bill 3403 is amended. This is the Ways and Means with no recommendation. Is that correct, Representative Devlin?
That is correct.
Thank you. Hold the roll, please.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
No.
Representative Lowe.
Yes.
Representative Montgomery.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Thank you. House Bill 3403 is moved to Ways and Means. Don't need a carrier, so we'll go back to our agenda, starting at the top. Make the bill up to House Bill 3090. We will open the public hearing on House Bill 3090. Janet, you have your guidance.
Okay.
Just let the few of the sponsors have a man.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 3090 would prohibit the Department of Transportation from beginning construction of a limited access state highway without determining that construction and maintenance costs are likely to be recovered through tolls within 30 years of the opening. It requires limited access highways that are built after the effective date of the act to be tollways built under the requirements of state law. Specifies that tolls can be uniform or based on the time of day. Mr. Chair, there's a little bit of additional background on tollway legislation in the background section of the staff measure summary and the statutes Chapter 383 related to tolls are also at your point.
Thank you. We have two people signed up to testify. Doug, Kendall, would you like to come forward? And then we also have Chris, there are two. Let's come together, that's fine. That's whatever you prefer.
Sure. Chairman, I might suggest that Chris probably could do a pretty good job explaining the basis for this bill, and she's kind of the person to put together. So.
Okay, thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Chris Hager-Bomer. I'm the Air and Transportation Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I'm really pleased to bring this bill in front of you, and a special thanks to the Vice Chair for sponsoring it. As you well know, Oregon lacks the revenue to keep pace with its pressing transportation needs. Projects across the state are being deferred because we simply don't have enough money to build them. In order to address just one of these transportation needs, road capacity, OEC suggests a new approach that would charge motorists more directly for their use of the roads and highways, and ultimately for their contribution to congestion. HB 3090 lays the foundation to rely more heavily on tolls to finance future modernization projects. We actually are suggesting some amendments to this that would make it a little bit less demanding, but I want to talk about the foundation, the principles behind this first. We used to charge tolls on many of Oregon's earliest roads and bridges, but since 1919, the primary source of funding has been the gas tax. The gas tax is unfortunately not a very accurate user fee. There are huge variations in the cost of a road from one road to another and the use of a road from one road to another and from one group of road users to another. Moreover, the gas tax each driver pays varies widely by how fuel efficient his or her vehicle is. Financing roads using the gas tax necessarily means that some drivers pay more than their fair share of costs, whereas others pay less. For example, if you're a rural driver on an empty country road, you may be subsidizing a motorist on a congested urban freeway if they're paying an equivalent amount put in the gas tax, because the urban freeway is more expensive to build and maintain. In addition, driving in heavy traffic imposes congestion costs and adds significantly to environmental pollution. Such cost subsidies can be reduced by implementing tolls. Most people imagine old-fashioned toll booths, but technology now makes it possible to implement tolls electronically without toll booths, allowing traffic to move freely. Toll financing is a way to approach road financing in a business-like manner. If drivers don't want a road project enough to pay for most of it through tolls, the project's cost-effectiveness comes into question. Moreover, if road users expect to pay tolls to cover the cost of a highway investment, they might press more vigorously for an efficient investment than if it were paid for out of the gas tax. Tolls can also be used to manage demand. Tolls that vary by time of day are used successfully on highways around the world, including California, to discourage discretionary travel on the busiest roads at the busiest hours. During peak hours on congested routes, tolls can be raised to account for the cost of congestion and lowered at less congested times. Drivers who pay a higher toll experience a faster, easier, less stressful trip. Others shift their trip to other times or switch to less congested roadways, take transit, or use carpools or van pools. because variable tolls reduce congestion, they reduce the need to build expensive new capacity. As I said earlier, we'd like to suggest some amendments to this bill. As originally written, HB 3090 would have required major new facilities to pay for themselves completely through tolls over a period of 30 years. We discussed this further with ODOT and other interested parties and decided we could achieve the same intent in a less onerous way. Representative Lehman has proposed the amendment being drafted by LC, and they would simply require ODOT to study the feasibility of tolls on major projects and use these findings as one criteria among many to decide whether a modernization project should be included in the SIP. We believe that the projects with a higher potential to be self-funded through tolls should rank higher than those where drivers are willing to pay less, but this doesn't need to be written into statute. The current amendments that are being drafted state that ODOT should analyze the potential for tolling on projects with a cost exceeding $10 million. We didn't pull this out of a hat. Actually, in 1995, the Minnesota legislature passed a similar statute that used $10 million as the cut point. But I think actually it would be more appropriate to name the type of modernization project as opposed to the cost of the project. Some modernization projects lend themselves to tolling, such as standalone new roadways or reconstruction of bridges or the addition of a full freeway lane. Since the committee is favorable toward the concept, we would like to submit more amendments that would state clearly which type of modernization project should be subject to such an analysis. So this bill does not require tolls, variable or otherwise, but we would hope that facilities that are able to be financed through tolls could be built as tollways. Adding this analysis to the criteria that ODOT must consider will have a fiscal impact, and ODOT will address this in their testimony. As the project proceeds through the planning process, it becomes easier to perform the analysis, but it should take place early enough in the process to be helpful in deciding how worthwhile a project is. If this bill passes, we believe that Origin has the potential to save millions of dollars in the long run, as construction of fiscally unsound projects could be avoided. There are really a number of reasons why people might be interested in toll financing. Some see tolls as a way to supplement the gas tax. Others see tolls as a way to manage demand for road space. We believe that tolls are a fair and efficient way to pay for new road capacity. The more efficient our transportation system is, the less damage we'll do to our environment. We urge you to lend your support to this bill, and I do have other supporters who, you know how difficult it is to get people here when people's schedules are busy, but one supporter who wanted me to say his name is Carl Hostica, former state legislator, who is very, very interested and knowledgeable about this subject. So I'd like to thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just a quick question, or a quick statement. We find it very difficult in this building to get a one-page bill through any committee. Particularly to have a 72-page bill. But having said that, I see that the committee, like myself, have been presented with some bashful amendments, and I'm sure a good representative would be able to explain to us. And as I did last session, I'd just like to comment on your testimony here. The Oregon Environmental Council is the Oregon's oldest statewide environmental group, and I'll remind you again, the Farm Bureau was formed before you were. Thank you. Representative Levin?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. The Dashmore Amendment was like two copies of it, and I just realized when Chris was speaking that there was sitting on my desk up there, and I didn't get them down here to get copies made. But I'll be happy to pass them out and look at it again.
Tell us what they say.
Basically, just what Chris outlined is that it's before proceeding with projects exceeding $10 million, that will determine what portion could be used or could be raised by toll, essentially, is what it says. And I'll be happy to pass it down and take a look at it.
Yes, can I see that?
Thank you. Maybe Doug can give us a little comment, and then we can get into the.
Doug, see the amendments?
I don't know. Can Sam just go run over to the machine and make copies for us so that we've got them?
Good morning.
Chair Montgomery, members of the committee, good morning. Doug Kendall, Oregon Department of Transportation. I think in Chris's testimony probably covered all of the points that I was going to make. Let me just highlight a couple of things. First, with respect to the the concept, tolling can be a useful tool, as Chris has suggested, in moving forward with modernization projects. With respect to the amendment, I think what Chris kind of ended up with is maybe we'd be better off going with the type of project rather than the cost of project. I can think of an interchange development, for instance, that would be over $10 million where tolling would be somewhat problematic to toll an interchange as opposed to tolling a new alignment or tolling a new bridge. So that, as Chris has suggested, that may be a more appropriate way to look at tolling. With respect to the fiscal, we think the cost of doing the assessment to see what the opportunity for tolling would be in the order of $25,000 to $50,000, depending on the type of project. Since we're probably talking about projects of substantial cost, that's not necessarily a significant cost in terms of the total project for a facility that may lend itself to tolling.
Thank you, Representative Reeland.
Chairman, looking at the amendments that say that with a cost exceeding $10 million, the Department of Transportation shall determine what portion of the cost of construction and maintenance could be recovered through tolls on new projects. With that kind of language, it would be possible for that community that we're going to build this interchange at $15 million, and right off the bat, we determine that tolling can have no impact on it because it already exists. Is that language sufficient for you to be able to say toll simply wouldn't work on this lane expansion where the existing highway is already there?
And Chair Montgomery, Representative Lehman, I think that's what the results would say. I guess my question then would be that we consider the toll potential in determining which modernization projects should be included in the FIP. So what do you use if I conclude that if that has no toll potential, how do I use that information then in including in prioritizing the FIP project? Would be my question.
Further questions, Representative Wells?
Representative Lehman had a copy of the statute here, and I got the book out. In statute 383.001 is under findings talking about toll roads. Evidently, we already had quite a bit of authority to enter into agreements on toll projects. It says in 383.005 the department may operate tollway projects and impose and collect tolls. So what does this bill do more than what we currently have on the books? Evidently, we have no statute that prohibits us to look at tollways in this state. What are we actually doing with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, our intent is that ODOT should always look at the potential tolls, but it has the ability to do so, and it currently doesn't do that.
Chair Montgomery, Representative Wells, maybe I'm misunderstanding the statutes, but I believe that ODOT does not have the authority to toll unless...
Generally pointing out in 383.007 restrictions on tollway projects, notwithstanding 005, without specific authorization, the department may not enter into any agreement for construction or operation other than the Newburgh-Dundee bypass, the Qualman-Sherwood Highway, a tollway project in whole and part in Portland metropolitan area, or a bridge near the site of Lewis and Clark.
Right.
So evidently they tell us we can do it, and then they turn around and we restricted it down to just a few projects. I didn't read the bottom of it.
Hey, Chair Montgomery, Representative Wells, that's my understanding also, and I probably should have mentioned that as a concern with the bill tells us to consider tolls, but then... it's not clear to me that it allows us to put the tolls on even after we consider them.
Thank you, Representative Crone, and then Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can tell you that with that the reason why that restriction at 383.007 was put into place in 1995 was to allow for the design and construction of those particular roads. I can't speak for the other roads, but I can tell you that the Falls to Sherwood Highway linking the I-5 to Highway 99 has gone absolutely nowhere.
That's really good. Taylor?
And the authority that we sought for replacing the Lewis and Clark Bridge across the Columbia at Rainier, is still in the works, and it was a toll bridge when it was built originally. It's now a 70-year-old bridge, and it will probably not be replaced by our current funds that are available between Washington's department and our own without a toll. So we really are still pursuing that. And I know that there's a feeling that with toll roads you pay twice, but if I might continue, Chair, but my home state is Oklahoma, and I can tell you that the turnpikes there are well used, and they people there are accustomed to originally throwing in your $1.60 to go from Oklahoma City to Tulsa at a good clip. Now, with the advent of transponders, I think this is a very timely suggestion. And given our situation with our backlog of projects that we need, I very much appreciate this suggestion being brought forward and can support it.
Thank you, Representative Krupp. And then we will go into work session if the committee would so desire.
Mr. Chair, I do desire to do just that. I think it's a great concept. I think this is the direction we need to go in this state. I fully concur with Representative Taylor. Having went to school in the Midwest, people have many alternatives from county roads to state highways plus toll roads, and we will have that opportunity in this state because we also have a good road system. People don't want to drive the toll way. They don't have to drive the toll way. They can find another way to go across the bridge, a river, go from one end of the state to the other under current methods. And I think we need to do this. I'm ready to go into work session, move the dash one, and get this thing out here.
Hearing no further discussion and no further comments, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3090. With the pleasure of the committee. We have a dash one amendment before us at this point.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment.
Move the dash one amendment to House Bill 3090. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So Representative Hill, excuse. We've moved the dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3090 to the floor with a due pass.
President Krupp moves House Bill 3090 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition?
Yes, there's no opposition.
I'm sorry, Richard Walker, yes.
I don't support the bill. I just don't like toll roads. Never have, never will. Sorry. I'll be there.
That's what democracy is all about. Thank you. Well, then, the clerk call the roll, please.
Representative Dentler.
Aye.
Representative Cook.
Aye.
Representative Cromwell.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Wilkin.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
No.
Representative Lowe.
Yes.
Representative Montgomery.
Aye. He moves House Bill 3090 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This is Representative Layman's bill. So, Representative, would you like to carry the bill?
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the oldest reasonable moderate environmental group in the state of Oregon, I'd be happy to carry the bill.
I'm not going there. Thank you very much. Next bill up is House Bill 3149. We'll open the public hearing to House Bill 3149. Janet, would you comment on this for the information benefit of the committee? There is a companion bill, it's House Bill 3150, that is currently in Ways and Means, and if the committee would so desire, it's the intent to send this bill on to Ways and Means to hold on to that other bill. At this point, I don't think any of your papers in front of you says that, but that was what there is. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm passing out because the amendments, we just got the amendments this morning. I'm passing out both the staff measure summary and the amendments at the same time.
Oh. Yes. Dash three amendments?
Yes, Mr.
I don't have any amendments.
I know.
Well, the case wants that.
And Mr. Chair, my staff in a summary, I'm hoping that is a dash three because I wrote it before I had the dash threes in my hands, but I think this is what they were going to do. Divides the elderly, renames, first of all, the currently the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund to become the Elderly and Disabled Special Mobility Fund and divides it into two parts, maintaining the current distribution of cigarette tax revenue for the current revenues that are coming in and that are transferred to the fund. And then for tax revenues that are from the general fund or other funds that become available to the mobility fund, distribution will be according to population. But it does, and that's population of either transit districts or counties. But it does specify minimum allocations provided to small population counties, so that counties that are under 10,000 population will receive a minimum of $40,000. Counties that are between 10 and 100,000 population will receive a minimum of $50,000. It also requires that just over half of the general fund appropriation be targeted to address needs of the unserved elderly or disabled persons. Also expands membership on the local advisory council to include additional representatives, and I think the sponsors of the bill will be able to explain those changes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We have a list of five people signed up to testify. We'll just go right down the list. If you're together with somebody, you're welcome to come up. Jacqueline, we have you here, and I see Martin Loring here. You coming up together, and Bernie, all three of you. That's fine. Thank you for being here.
Okay, I have a question.
Do well.
The Dash agrees to remove the cigarette settlement money out of the original bill.
Sure.
Where is that language?
I think that the Dash agrees are delete the entire original bill. And
well, this becomes...
This becomes the new bill.
Okay, that's right.
Okay, whoever would like to lead off, you're welcome. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer. I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. We're commonly referred to as O4AD. This morning, we did not put together a large amount of testimony for you because you graciously heard some testimony earlier this session from a number of users of the system. And you heard about the ODOT survey that was completed, and you've heard some work about, heard some information about need. So this morning, what I thought I would do initially is just give you a little bit of sort of what's new about the bill. There were some Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments that were proposed. We're not using those. We have substituted the Dash 3 amendments for the bill, as the community administrator stated. And most of the changes that have been made are very, really very minor. For example, one just changes the name from the Special Transportation to the Elderly and Disabled Mobility Fund, that sort of thing. But I thought I would go through a few of the components of the Dash 3 amendments. Bernie will be here to answer questions, and then Martin Loring is here from ODOT in case anyone has questions about the survey or formulas or something along those lines. And we've touched base with a lot of you, so if you need more detail, feel free to ask. But I don't want to use up all of your time this morning. We want to make certain that you understand that the bill divides the formula for distributing money into two parts, the existing cigarette tax money that you currently receive. The formula for distribution of those funds will remain the same. That whole system will remain the same. But any new funds that we get will be distributed, as Janet mentioned earlier, under a formula that targets population. Smaller populations will receive a $40,000 base plus some additional funding for population. Counties between 10,000 and 100,000 will receive a minimum of $50,000 plus population. And then keep in mind, they'll still receive their cigarette tax revenue that they're already getting on top of that. And then in the larger counties with over 100,000 population, they'll receive this population-based funding of their cigarette tax revenue that goes right now. There's some language in here that requires that 51% of any new general fund appropriations go to serve for the unserved elderly or disabled. That is to say, there are a lot of elderly and people with disabilities who really don't meet the ADA requirements that transit districts sort of have had to enact, and they've had to do that because they don't receive much funding to provide the service in the first place. So a lot of people that really are deserving of rides get left standing on the corner because they don't quite meet the criteria. The AAAs are interested in working with the local transit districts to help define eligibility. We think they might be fairly qualified to help define eligibility. And so you'll see us with this new money working to actually meet needs that are out there, maybe through more enhanced door-through-door service and some other steps that we can take to actually meet those unmet needs. The other thing that we've done is each area has each transit area has a committee, an advisory council, that makes recommendations about how revenue is spent for elderly and disabled transportation. We've made some changes to that to include representation by people with disabilities and by an area agency on aging director or representative of an area agency on aging, so that we can again take a more comprehensive look at the needs that are out there and how the money gets spent and make recommendations along those lines. Those are the basic components of that gasoline money.
Thank you. Well, if you want to wait till they're through,
go ahead then.
Okay, we'll share with you this
one. Well, then go ahead.
Thank you, Bernie.
Mr. Chair, Bernie Bottomley from Climate. I think Dana did a good job of summarizing the bill. What we wanted to do was to retain the existing formulas for the cigarette tax funds that are now in place to ensure that those communities that use those funds now will continue to be able to use those funds and budget for those funds in the future because they're an ongoing stable source of funding, and then set up a parallel structure for distributing any general fund monies or other funds that the legislature might appropriate for elderly and disabled transportation and make those funds serve a couple of purposes. One is to set up a floor, if you will, for the smallest counties and make sure that they have enough money to run an adequate program, even though their population base, if you just did it on population, wouldn't really provide them with enough money to run a program. And then to focus, as Jacqueline said, on the folks who are insured with a portion of that money. Just one additional thought. The same part of the statute that applies to the cigarette tax now, dealing with what we call maintenance of effort, will apply to the new fund. So we won't be using any of this funding to backfill our general fund. And you know, we won't be moving that money out to something else. This will go to new services, and that portion of that requirement is in the statute now, and will apply to the new funding itself.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Montgomery, committee members. I'm Martin Loring, manager of the Public Transit Division of ODOT. That is the place where the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund is currently administered. We think it's a good program that's done a good job meeting the transportation needs of the elderly and disabled. We agree with everyone that more money is needed to assist the elderly and disabled in getting around to doctor's appointments, shopping, what have you, the things that they need to maintain a high quality of life. The original bill, 3149, made some changes that were of concern to the department. We've been working hard with every conceivable group that had an interest in this bill and have pulled together a set of amendments that you have before you in the form of the -3 amendments to the bill that we think makes a good program even better, and we endorse them. Currently, this is a program that serves very, very many small entities. There's some 110 grant recipients, include some gas companies. I won't go through the list, but Chetco Senior Center, Sir Optimus International in Crook County, City of Cascade Locks, South Lane Wheels, Wheels of Joy.
What a coincidence.
These are small entities that depend on this to pay the operational cost of delivering transportation services to the senior and disabled, and also use it to buy vehicles. The -3 composes a good bill, and I hope you are able to support it.
Thank you, Martin. We have Representative Wells with a question. Representative Flummel. Representative Loken.
Thank you. I kind of coined this bill as Oregon's senior disabled
Transportation Efficiency Act.
So ICT 21, this is Oregon's, as you know, of course, ICT or T21 is the way, is a disbursement method of the highway trust funds at the federal level. And so what we have here is a, as I understand, is a disbursement method of how we're going to disperse, anticipating $10 million plus cigarette money and everything. So I look at it as a disbursement mechanism. I understand there's a competing disbursement method idea coming to the same committee from the Senate. How is all this going to boil down when 764 and this bill collide?
Chair Representative Wells, I can't answer that definitively, but my understanding is that 764 has been moved down to the Ways and Means Committee. Senator Hannon, who is on the Senate Transportation Committee, also serves as the chair of the Transportation Subcommittee of Ways and Means. Senator Dukes is also on that committee, on both committees, and Senator Yee. So they agreed in committee that they would take the bill down to Ways and Means. They knew that this bill would be coming their way as well, and they're going to work to meld those two ideas together.
Is going to ask the question of the Congress Senate Bill 764. Representative Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I have is relevant to page 2 of the dash 3 amendments. Starting on line 17 and line 26, it says there that each mass transit district or transportation district shall receive the share of the money, so on and so forth. Line 24, it says if there are two or more transportation districts in the county, if only the transportation district with the highest population is located in that county, is how it sounds to me that's being treated. My question is this. I have two transportation districts in my district. One is TriMet, the other is the South Metro Area Rapid Transit. Now, TriMet obviously has the largest population base in Clackamas County, even though they don't serve the rest of the outlying areas of Portland all that well. Does this mean that the dollars from this fund are going to go to TriMet and that Smart sits there, and even though they're providing services to senior and disabled, they get nothing, and they're just sort of on their own?
Chair Montgomery, Representative Crummell, that's a good question. This language is exactly mirrors the current language.
I understand that. I found it mostly in the bill.
Right. And what we do is where there's a district like TriMet or any other transit district, traditionally the funding from the state, from the cigarette tax, has gone to the transit district for the entire county. And then the transit district calculates the different population inside the district versus in the remainder of the county, and then they pass those funds through to the county. In the case of TriMet, where there are two districts, we do the same calculation, only we go one increment further. We calculate the amount of the population that's inside the TriMet district versus in the remainder of the county and the portion that's in the other transit district, and we allocate those proportionally.
So the dollars, if I'm following, so the dollars come from, for example, going to SMART, which is the dollars that come directly from the state into the SMART account, or they go through TriMet, and then TriMet skims off a little for an administrative tax.
Representative Montgomery, we don't skim off any. It goes to TriMet as a bureaucratic thing. But it's simply a pass-through to the county and to the other transit districts.
For the record, there's no administrative cost.
No administrative cost.
Thank you. Representative Wilson?
Good question. And earlier, I received quite a bit of information from small districts around the state and on their needs. I was just wondering if in setting these allocations that different areas have different needs, and is there any consideration of that? Is it just a flat allocation, 40,000, small district? How do you have requirements or needs identified so that it can be the distributor who needs it and not so much those that don't need it so much.
Chair Montgomery, Representative Loken, the current fund is divided into two parts. 75% goes out on a population basis, and 25% is in a discretionary fund. The first thing that's done with the discretionary money is to bring the six smallest counties in Oregon up to a minimum level of $34,000 for the biennium. What this set of amendments does with the new money is move more of the money to the rural parts of the state. The $40,000 and $50,000 bases proposed amount to $1,270,000, which would be moved from the more populous to the less populous counties of the state. We believe that that better represents the higher cost of meeting the need in the smaller areas of the state. That's a long-winded way of answering, yes, I believe it better meets the need.
We have two more people to testify, and we need to move on. So thank you all very much for being here. Mel Zucker, you're our next one. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
If you have prepared testimony, I hope you can paraphrase it for us, because we do have the training. It may not go anywhere, but we're going to move it, or kill it, one of the two.
Is it still coming to our committee, or is it, do we have it up?
No.
Chair, Representative Taylor, that Senate bill passed the Senate committee is going to the Ways and Means on the Senate side, and I'm sending that to you.
Okay.
Thank you. Morning, Mel. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Mel Zucker, Portland, Oregon. I'm opposed to this bill because it's not as good as 764 that's come out of the Senate and Senate Ways and Means for. A lot.
For the record, did you support 764 then?
I supported 764. The other bill that was really started, well, we started working on a disabled bill because everybody in the building wants to get more money and get it in the right way to the seniors and disabled. And it's just a matter of how to do it. We started working on this 18 months ago, and then we lined up with the Governor's Commission on the Aging, and they really brought a lot of good things to the other bill. And the other bill is much better because this bill merely perpetuates a poor and uncoordinated system of distribution and accountability. Small providers with small or volunteer staffing didn't provide the required information correctly, and the ODOT personnel never communicated to get accurate information. In other words, in what's been handled by ODOT right now, it's been very poor. If you take a look at the record and go through the database, you'll find just terrible things going. And what we wanted to do was put it together, and it was Bill Fisher's idea, with human resources. Okay. A federal DOT report called Improving Transportation for a Maturing Society concluded that 90% of Americans retire in place. That means they stay where they live before retirement. The suburbs and rural areas that have a higher percentage of older Americans than urban areas. These are areas where there is little or no transit. And in most of the geography of Oregon, there's no transit. With the STF fund, the Special Transportation Fund, not to be confused with STP, that has been providing about $5 million a year. And if we divide that by 240 cities, that's less than $21,000 per city. Not enough to pay for one driver, not even a half of a driver. And that doesn't speak to anything about maintenance or anything else. The FTG fund, that's the grant fund that goes along with it, has been going at a clip of about $1.3 million a year. And that, at the cost of one paratransit vehicle is about $45,000. That wouldn't buy one vehicle per county. Funds are scarce, and what we need to do is carefully weigh how we put them all together and coordinate so we can get the biggest bang for our buck. The federal report points out that not providing transit for transit dependents in rural and suburban areas forces these people into isolation or into publicly funded care, which is much more expensive. And coordination is a big key to making our funds go further. Exhibits 1 and 2 that you have before you show how deeply involved human resources is with providing services to the disabled. ODOT's present role in the process is a pass-through with simple clerical duties, which they are not doing very well. When you return to your offices, look at the staff phone directory, and you'll find offices for the DHR functions shown in Exhibit 1 all over the state, providing services to the same people that we fund with STG and STF. Just calling for coordination between agencies in a bill or in an executive order merely sets up monthly meetings between duplicating bureaucracies. We need to look at all the transportation resources in the community and utilize them fully. And that may even include school buses. With scheduling, we get much more bang for our buck. In rural areas, the disabled program should be the nucleus of a transit system, providing unused capacity on a disabled transit vehicle to others willing to share the trip. Presently, we allot STP funds on the basis of population, but with the large population centers already have transit agencies with vehicles conforming to ADA. The rural areas do not have ADA vehicles or other transit. Exhibits 3 and 4 show the SDG allocation.
Are you going to go through all these exhibits, Mr. Zucker? No, we don't have time for all exhibits, so if you could paraphrase those, I really appreciate it.
Would you rather me take you through the testimony, through the exhibits? And on the, let's go to Exhibit 5. Exhibit 5 shows the transit revenue from taxes that have been received by TriMet. And as you can see, the increase in just the last year is more than four times bigger than the funding for elderly in transit for the whole state. Now, when the people pass this, these payroll taxes, they didn't think it was exclusively for the non-seniors. It was to be used for seniors, and they were very, very well funded. Exhibit C shows the average STF fund amount allotted to providers by counties for 6 years. The data is from ODOT. It also shows the cost per ride and cost per mile. The three counties are missing are Washington, Clackamas, and Polk because there's those prime there. And by the way, it doesn't get funneled back to providers proportionally. And the only way you can see that is by looking at the database which shows the actual list of providers. Exhibit 7 shows that we have certain providers that have heavier costs, much heavier than other providers. And according to the testimony at the latest TriMet fare increase hearing, TriMet's current cost per ride is $14.88. And you can see how much that's out of whack with the state average for doing this. Obviously, some providers are doing a much better job at combining trips and are utilizing drivers and vehicle time better. And with scarce resources, we have to be effective, and that's why we have a productivity clause in SB 764. A study by Charlie Lave at UC Irvine on transit subsidies shows that subsidies have increased, but productivity has fallen. we must not let that happen. So we want to really do something to stress productivity when we put money into something. Exhibit A shows the number of SDF providers per county and the size of the counties. Not all of the providers receive SDF funds. There simply is not enough coverage. We need to get more resources in the areas with no coverage. To make matters worse, look at the lost timber tax revenues on Exhibit 9, and those people, those counties, are really hurting in every way, and we're just not getting enough. SB 764 has the flexibility to get money where it's needed. And you need flexibility in a program, because if you just funnel money equally out, they aren't absorbed equally by counties. Certain of them are ready to do more and need more at any particular time. I've received the amendments to 3149 late yesterday, and I made a distribution of what that would look like. This will then on.
If you could do it in another minute and a half, I'd appreciate it, because we have another person to testify, and we need to shut this down four con at 9:45. I know it's short notice, but we're on short time right now. So thank you, and I hope you understand our need to kind of move along here.
All right. Well, here's the distribution of 3149, and as you can see how it breaks out by county, there's not enough really to do much of a job in most of the counties. And that's with the minimums. And you can see that that middle minimum, $50,000 minimum, doesn't even come into effect when you do it. Now, I've allotted it based upon $10 million per biennium and the current SDF allotment from the cigarette tax. And this is the way that breaks out. I was going to say a lot more, but since you're in a rush, that's it.
Thank you. Any questions in the committee? Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Zucker, for being here. I'm sorry, but the clock is running, and we have a lot of work to do, so I appreciate you coming in and giving us the information.
We'll have Mr. Benke here with us today. Benke.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bob Benke. I'm a transportation consultant. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I want to have just a couple of points in the interest of time. I am opposed to this bill. I looked at the Senate bill that essentially gives the administration responsibility for the funds to the Department of Human Resources versus this bill, which gives it to ODOT. And I think the human resources approach, more of a user-side subsidy rather than a provider-side subsidy, is a more efficient way to do things. I went back and looked at the Oregon Transportation Plan, which was approved about 7 or 8 years ago. And it's very interesting, in ODOT's own plan here, if you look at the definition of public transit, it excludes services to senior citizens. And it excludes also carpooling. Yeah, specifically the definition, if I can read it, it's a very short. Public transit is defined as bus, van, light rail, and other surface transportation systems open to the general public, which operate frequently and on predetermined routes and schedules. Public transit does not include carpools or senior van services, but may include intercity bus and rail services if the service is frequent. In addition, looking at the there are a couple of benchmarks in the public transit area in this plan here that were developed for the year 2000 and the year 2010. And there were three of them that relate to reducing the vehicle miles traveled per capita in a state by greater use of public transportation. There's another one by increasing the number of people who use transit to get back and forth to work. And there's another one dealing with the level of congestion we're going to have on our urban freeway. The governor's Oregon Progress Report, which the governor chairs, recently came out with a report card on a number of benchmarks for the state. And the three transit-related benchmarks that ODOT had listed for public transportation back in the Oregon Transportation Plan, received grades of F, F, and B minus. And so the performance so far by ODOT in the public transit area have not been very spectacular. And lastly, I have a personal interest in this. I'm a card-carrying member of AARP. And secondly, I'm a transportation consultant looking at the application of new computer and communication technologies to make transit, particularly public transit, and all other kinds of transportation, more cost-effective. The federal government has large numbers of programs and funds that are very much geared towards matching state monies that are available in order to do a much better job. And one of the high-priority areas is services for elderly and handicapped, because right now the costs are very, very high. We have a letter from ODOT during the last session that says the statewide average for rides for seniors and disabled people is $5. If you look in the Portland area, it's about $15. If you look outside the Portland area, it's about $2.50. And I think if you look at the way Senate Bill 764, the money is going to be distributed and handled closer to the users rather than to the providers, I think the state would get much more bang for its buck out of this that approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it very much. Thanks for your understanding and our needing to move on, too. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3149. We can go into work session if the committee would like. We have some additional amendments. We have a bill. In fact, we will. This is the opportunity to go into work session. We're in work session, House Bill 3149. Dashwood Amendment,
yes, yes, Bill, whatever we do, it's
Dashwood. Thank you, Representative Wells.
Chairman, I move the Dashwood Amendment.
This is Layman moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3149. Is there discussion on the committee? Hearing none, is there any opposition? No opposition. Representative Hill excused. We have now before us House Bill 3149 as amended.
Chairman, I move House Bill 3149 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means of Recourse Recommendation.
Representative Layman moves the House Bill 3149 as amended to Ways and Means of the Due Path Recommendation. This gives them the opportunity to prepare Senate Bill 64 with their budget and Senate House Bill 3150, which is down there at the present time, and maybe they can come up with something to follow it. Is there any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would just make one point, Mr. Chair, that the funding levels that we have for our seniors and disabled are not adequate, and I, for the life of me, have not been able to figure out why we continue to fund programs that have an increasing need or an accelerated need with a decreasing revenue source. The actual need on this program is $135 million. In 1997, it was cut to $50 million, and now we're going to take it down to $10
million. If everybody paid the same that our good friends in Cascade Locks does, which is $4.50 per ride, maybe the state would be in better shape. And those people want it, they love it, and they got mad when I even asked them a question because they thought I was trying to do away with it. Not 50 cents, $4.50 per ride. And they can find the money, and they're on fixed income, and we're supporting Cascade Lots and can't afford to get out of town.
Is there any opposition to this? Hearing none.
The Ways and Means is Representative Hill showing excuse. Thank you. The last bill we have on the agenda is we have sessions at 11, I believe. I'd like to see us out here at 10:15 if we can make it. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill
3292. Eric? House Bill 3292, and we have two amendments. The bill, original bill, requires persons or
companies. When we have amendments to get, we know who they came from. It helps us before we even get into explaining it.
Okay.
You know who they're from?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but the Dashland amendments came from a group that between the Trucking Association, Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association, the Oregon Trucking Association, discussing with Representative DMD, the Attorney General's Office, Legislative Council, and I think that was a group, discussing ways to make the bill more likely to meet constitutional challenges. And the Dash 2 amendments were also as a result of that effort. They go a little bit further in trying to protect the state from constitutional challenges under due process and privacy requirements.
So these are friendly amendments to the presenters of the bill. Thank you.
I'm not sure that, Mr. Chair, but they can say so or not when they come up. Mr. Chair, current federal and state law require motor carriers, that includes trucking companies and individuals that own trucks, to either establish an in-house drug and alcohol testing program or to be a member of a consortium that provides such testing. But and the laws do require pre-employment testing, random and post-accident testing of drivers. But when a driver applies to a carrier, the carrier is required to do a background check, but that means previous employers. And if the individual driver that's applying for the job doesn't list previous employers, there's no way to know that they had a positive drug test under a previous employer. So the bill requires persons and companies that register vehicles to certify that they have this program before they can register the vehicle, and also requires the company's medical review officer, and that's a term you may hear again, to report a positive drug test to the Department of Transportation. And then it would become part, which is not the case now, part of the employer's, the driver's employment driving record. And that's available currently to anyone who requests it. That is a new requirement, and that's the question that the department has about whether that's a privacy and due process problem under the Constitution. A Dash 1 amendment require the department to notify the driver that he or she has a right to a hearing about placing this information on the employment driving record, and provides that the department may not be held liable for damages resulting from placement of the information on the driving record. The bill amendments also delay the operative date to give the department more time to be able to comply, and the Dash 2 amendments incorporate all those changes from the Dash 1 amendments, but specify that DMV can only provide the new drug test portion of the employment driving records to a person who has the written notarized consent of the driver. We will also have Legislative Council down here if you have questions about the constitutional due process and privacy concerns. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, everyone. We have a list of people signed up. I'd like to compliment the Trucking Association, all of them, for the responsible position they're taking and the desire to keep our roads safe. Thank you all, gentlemen, very much for the bill. We appreciate it. On our sign-up sheet, we have, I don't know who all would like to talk. We have Bob McKellar, Oregon Trucking Association, John Shalek, did I pronounce your name right? Who all have signed up together. Marshall, your name's not here, but please come on up. Bob Russell, all of you, come on up if you want to.
Mr. Chairman, I don't even know if we need testimony. It's the only time the chair of the two committees can get together on something. That's a major accomplishment. You ought to pass it on through.
Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, we'll go into work session.
Okay, with us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Marshall Tober, representing the Oregon Trucking Association, here today in support of House Bill 3292, including the Dash 1 Amendment. House Bill 3292 is supported by several of Oregon's trucking associations in addition to the OTA. We believe this is an important highway safety bill that will make Oregon a leader in drug and alcohol enforcement of commercial drivers. And to review the bill and related issues is John Salek, the OTA Safety Director. John?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Salek. I am the Safety Director for the Oregon Trucking Association. We represent about 600 motor carriers who operate commercial vehicles in Oregon. We're here in support of House Bill 3292. You've heard a brief description of the rule that applies today for mandatory drug and alcohol testing in the trucking industry. We've had that rule for several years now, and it's done a lot to enhance safety on the highway. We've removed many people from commercial vehicles because they tested positive for drugs or alcohol. There are a couple of weak spots. One is simply that a lot of companies are still not participating and having an in-house or consortium-type drug and alcohol testing program. They've chosen not to comply. This bill would put some more teeth in the law and death penalties for those who do not comply. There's also a problem in that we have a responsibility as employers in this industry to track previous positive drug and alcohol tests. We do that to the best of our ability with the information that's given to us. However, it's possible for an applicant to ask for a job but test positive for drugs or alcohol and then go on down the road, and at some point when he or she thinks that they may be able to provide a clean sample, test again with another employer. That employer has no opportunity to find out about the previous positive test. Or if someone is driving and during the course of their employment they're picked for a random or a reasonable cause or a post-accident drug test, if that becomes positive and they lose their job, they may go on to another employer and choose not to list the previous employer. So the new employer has no way, again, of knowing about that positive drug or alcohol test. We believe that this bill would close that loophole and, again, make it possible for us to provide safe trucks and drivers on the highway. It's not an Oregon problem. It's not unique to Oregon. This happens in every state with commercial motor vehicles, but Oregon is the one that's trying to address it, and this is somewhat of a cutting-edge type of legislation. We believe that it's very important, and we believe that if we're successful here, others will follow. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you, John, and thanks for waiting us out this morning. We appreciate your patience. Are there questions for Devlin and then Will?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Assuming this bill passes through the legislature, if we add the dash twos, which includes that the employee would have to sign for the record to be released, could you, under normal circumstances, always request as a condition of employment that an employee sign such a release? And if you didn't, if an employer didn't, couldn't they be into some liability since they didn't inquire as to the previous record of the employee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, there already is a release that every driver applicant signs authorizing the employer to send for driving information and previous drug and alcohol testing information and employment histories. So that's already in effect. The Dash 2 amendment, however, requires notarizing that release, and that could be a problem for us in the hiring practice to try and find a notary at certain points.
Yes, your point's well taken because there is a one in Cascade Locks. Representative Wells?
Well, thank you. I was wondering what.
I need to wonder what is. Do you have a grocery store?
You see them soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering what was driving this bill. Is it federal law, state law, or something that you people want to do? What is the background of this issue, and why are we here with this bill?
Chairman Montgomery and Representative Wells, I'd like to ask Bob McCullough from the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association to answer that, because he's had more personal experience with it than I have.
My name is Bob McCullough from OFPTA. Let me just read in our newsletter, our April newsletter. We have the OFPTA contracts with a firm here in Salem called Biomed. It's owned and operated by a lady named Candace Phillips, who also provides a testing service for the state of Oregon for the Department of Transportation and a variety of other people. She writes in this newsletter, and this is a direct answer to your question. She writes in this newsletter, we have seen a pattern of deception develop that you should, she's writing to our members. We have seen a pattern of deception develop that you should be on the lookout for. Let me give you an example. We received a request for the testing history of a driver. The driver listed three employers he had worked for in the last 2 years. I immediately recognized his name. Our records show that he had at least 6 positive methamphetamine drug tests for various companies, including a post-accident test and 2 random tests. The driver, however, had not listed any of these particular employers, so we could not legally release any of the positive test results to the new employer. In fact, when the new employer sent us the driver's release form, he remarked, you won't have any problem with this guy. I'm positive he doesn't use drugs. Let me give you one more example. We have a member in Long Creek, Oregon, who has several trucks, and he hires drivers, and he had a driver that tested positive. He pays all the fees, all the testing fees, all of the requirement he does. He had a driver that tested positive. The driver went down the road, and a week later was driving for one of his competitors who does not have any sort of a testing program. So we have two problems here, and this bill addresses both of them. One is the drivers who are deceptive, and secondly, the companies in the state of Oregon who are running the risk of by not having a testing program. And so the bill increases the fines for those trucking companies who do not, and provides a mechanism to be sure that all of the companies are in a testing program somewhere. This bill came directly from the trucking industry as a safety bill, as Marshall told you. It is a bill, it is one of two bills that we think are very important, and it came directly from the trucking industry.
Thank you, Representative Trump. And then Strong.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just briefly, is this bill, this is applicable to anyone who uses CDL drivers, including motorhome companies, motorhome manufacturers? John, you and I were at a meeting, guarantee, on this matter. Does it include them, and does it also exempt, or does it include everyone who, even a guy who owns his own truck, an owner-operator who's out there trucking on the road?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Is that your
question?
Good enough. That's Representative Crummel, and then we'll move on to, we have two of the people to testify, Representative Walker, after Representative Crummel, then we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that you cited 49 CFR Part 382 of the U.S. Code. Is that where the substances that are banned is described at?
The banned substances are described in Part 382 and also in Part 40 of 49 CFR.
Okay. And then, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, what's the effect of this bill will have on companies that are actually domiciled outside of Oregon, but they have drivers that drive in the state? Is it anybody that operates a commercial vehicle anywhere in the state of Oregon that is subject to the test?
It's my understanding that this would only apply to an Oregon licensed driver at this time.
President Walker?
Hey, Mr. Chair. My question is, ODOT going to testify?
That's what I said. We have two members. We have the state police out here, too, and we also, for the benefit of the committee, you all know Joan Robinson. She's sitting in here, so.
Okay, then I'll say.
Only come unless she has some concerns.
I'll save my question for ODOT if that's more the department's question.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for being here. I'm sorry, Bob.
Could I add one sentence?
Well, you have more than that.
No, that's enough. Bob McKellar, we support the Dash 1 amendments because finding a notary in the woods is a little difficult.
Thank you. We do have state police here, Alan Hagman, and then also Kelly Taylor. So we can come up together or separately. So, good morning, Sergeant. Thanks for being here.
Morning. Chair Montgomery, members of the committee, my testimony is very short. I only wanted to go on record for the state police for being supportive of this bill. It appears it's going to be proactive in transportation safety, and that's the basis for our support. That's my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for being here, sir, and thanks for waiting for that. By the way, we might have some questions if you're progressed here, but at this point, it seems fine. Thank you, Kelly. Thanks for being here this morning. Kelly Taylor.
Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. I'll just briefly go through a few things. We do have serious concerns that when we talked with our Attorney General with the original bill, and the Dash 1 and Dash 2s are trying to get at that. The Dash 2 address all of the concerns. Even though a employer is supposed to get written consent, we would not know that they had or had not really done that. That's why we were asking for the written consent, so that we would know we could release it. There are some court cases apparently talking about the U.S. Constitution and privacy of personal information, et cetera, so we were trying to be careful on liability there. I'll get down to some of the expenditures. The Dash 1 amendments, the expenditures are about $333,000, I'm just going to round it up, in the first biennium, and $321,000 in the second. The Dash 2 are about $30,000 more in the first biennium, same for the second. The expenditures for both sets of amendments include an additional 3 FTE for processing the additional hearing requests. Neither set of amendments has an effect on revenue. Please ignore the first paragraph on the second page. I forgot that you had put in the amendments a later operative date, so ignore my usual paragraph about that. Issues to consider, we realized yesterday in looking through it that the bill doesn't require, it doesn't have a timeline as to how soon after the positive test results the medical review officer is supposed to report to the department. So we don't know if there's going to be some time lag there or anything. And Section 2 of the bill specifies a motor carrier must meet federal requirements, and the definition of motor carrier in federal regulation indicates a for-hire or private motor carrier. And so all employers who employ drivers of commercial motor vehicles or motor vehicles are subject to participating, with the exception of military, farmers, and firefighters. But we're wondering if the term motor carrier, which is referred to as for-hire or private motor carrier in the Part 382, it would be excluding, we believe, public employers. So getting back to Representative Krupp's answer, I'm not sure the term motor carrier will actually encompass everybody who, because, you know, the for-hire and the commercial and all that. Just a comment we need to look into, make sure we don't miss somebody if that's not the intent of the bill. That would be about the only comments I have.
Senator Kelly, Representative Walker, do you have some questions before we go to Wells?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Ms. Taylor, in the bill, it says there will be a report put on the person's driving record.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call a driving record? We're not talking about a strike on a driver's license, are we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, the driving record is the database and all the entries that we maintain, convictions, accidents. This would be an entry showing a positive test result that would be on the employment part of your record.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Wells.
Thank you. Kelly, in Section 4, is that where it exempts non-domiciled vehicles from being covered, because we said the original bill says at the time of registration, or renewal registration, and out-of-state trucks are registered here on a...
Mr. Chair and Representative Wells, it would be any vehicle that's registered here that's going through renewal. And so if they're registered here and applying for renewal or for first-time registration, then the motor carrier would have to disclose who's handling their drug testing operation, whether it's themselves or a consortium or something like that.
Does this apply to out-of-state carriers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wells, not if they're not registered here. If they're just coming through the state, it doesn't affect them.
Even though they have a prorationed plate, so to speak, they're traveling in four states and they're registering part of their registration fee is in this state. They have a...
Chair Representative Wells, I'm not sure. I'd have to ask. But I'm not sure how registration is defined versus prorated, where the money might be collected by their home state and just divvied out to Oregon. It may just be appeased, and that may not be registered as part of what this bill talks about. I'd have to check into that for you.
Thank you, Kelly. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Taylor.
Could we remove the word notarized, and would it change the intent of the Dash 2, or would that make the one that speaks to a notarized consent unneeded, too weak?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, I have not had a chance. I only got these late yesterday, and I have not had a chance to actually have the AG look through them to see if it truly encompassed the concerns we were doing. I don't know that notarized needs to be in there or not. I would ask our Attorney General whether they did. I know she talked about written consent, but I don't remember her saying it had to be notarized, but I don't remember.
Thank you. We do have General Robinson to bring us some legal technical questions. Joan, do you have some words of wisdom for us? Thank you for being here.
We're getting close to going home, so you can rest a little bit. You've got 5 more months.
I'm very happy to hear it, but next week is going to be an easy time because you're finishing all House Bills Friday, I understand.
For the record.
No. Right. Representative Montgomery, Members of the Committee, I'm Joan Robinson from Legislative Council. As you've heard, we had a meeting on constitutional concerns that were raised by the Department of Justice on the original bill. And both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments, as Kelly said, address those concerns. I can't speak for the Department of Justice. I think their Attorney General is more concerned about constitutionality than I am, but neither one of us, and that's her job, because Department of Justice would have to defend this bill if it passes and is challenged. Neither one of us is able to say with certainty that the bill as drafted would withstand a constitutional challenge. The Dash 1 amendments take care, I think, of all of the issues except the privacy concerns under the federal constitution. And the reason that privacy concerns are raised in the Dash 1 amendments is that the employment driving record, which would contain this information, is a public record and anyone has access to it. There's no case that we've been able to find that deals with a situation like this because, as the representatives from the trucking industry indicated, this would be a cutting-edge kind of bill. There's no other state that has a bill like this. So we don't have a case to point to that says, yeah, what we find is unconstitutional. So the most that I can tell you about the Dash 1 amendments is they might be subject to challenge on privacy grounds. Some trucker whose positive test result was put on the employment driving record could challenge that under the United States Constitution, and then Department of Justice would have to defend that constitutional challenge, and I don't know what the result would be. So that's a caution. The Dash 2 amendments were drafted in order to take care of that problem because if the person gives permission, then there is no privacy problem. You can always waive whatever right to privacy there might be. However, I found out this morning, and I apologize for not having found this out sooner, but I was busy. And I don't know what it means. There is a federal law that went into effect on January 31st of this year when newly hired drivers that it preempts state and local law, which means you can't do anything that violates it. And in a section that generally exempts motor carriers from liability for giving safety performance records to other motor carriers, they have this sentence: notwithstanding any provision of law, written authorization shall not be required to obtain information on the motor vehicle driving record of an individual under consideration for employment with a motor carrier. It's not at all clear to me that that applies to DMV, because the whole rest of the section is about transactions between motor carriers. But if you take it out of context, you can certainly argue that it prohibits what we're trying to do in the Dash 2 amendments. And I don't know where that leaves you. Leaves you in a difficult situation. And just having to guess, I think. Sorry.
So may I paraphrase what you said? We don't know whether this is legal or not.
We don't know whether it's constitutional or not.
It's a difficult situation. We're trying to save lives. This is absolutely a life-saving bill. I could ask the state trooper here. I'm not sure if you keep records. You must keep records, but you may not know this left field question. Some of these trucks come into the state, make our other truckers look bad. They get in a wreck. They shut down the freeway for 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 hours, and it's because they're probably on drugs or something. Do you keep a record of how? And that is never included in any of these cost figures. That's a big cost. Shut down the freeway, and they'll have our state troopers standing out there guiding traffic when they should be saving lives. Do you know how many of the trucks that are wrecked out there and shut down the freeway, and they're not picking on trucks and standing up for them, are drug related?
Sean Montgomery, no, I don't know if that's tracked, the percent.
That's the thing that should be tracked, but it isn't. Anyhow, that's why I get so disappointed in some of these cost figures, because they don't reflect the true cost. I think this is a heck of a good bill, and I really compliment the trucking industry, and we're trying to find ways not to do it rather than ways to do it. Everybody wants to talk. We've got 5 minutes to do it in.
I just was wondering if the Trucking Association would nod their head. If we just remove the last sentence on page 2, 26 and 27, just saying the Whitman Commission must be notarized to resolve their problem.
Removing requirements.
What's the notary requirement? Was that your question? I'm sorry. That can't be in here.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. I was going to tell you where that came from. Came out of my head, but plagiarized from the Driver Privacy Protection Act that you passed last session. I don't think the requirement is necessary, but it's in the Driver Privacy Protection Act, you may recall, people can give permission for the otherwise protected information to be given out, but it has to be notarized. So I just copied that. That's the only place it came from. My fertile brain.
Thank you, Representative Cuomo. And then Walker, Representative Walker, for your benefit, the reason some small towns don't have notaries, this body made it so difficult to be a notary public. I was one. I don't want to do the paperwork. How about you did the same thing?
I gave it up. No, I gave it up.
For the same reason.
Our association, Court Reporter Association, got an agreement that we didn't have to be notaries.
Well, we did it for ourselves. This government did. Representative Cuomo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to the dash 1 or dash 2, it doesn't matter, subsection 7 of section 7 on page 2, starting on line 15. The exemption from civil liability for the department, I'm a little concerned about that from the standpoint of giving the department carte blanche with regards to the releasing of information, and was wondering if we couldn't put something in there that would specify as long as the release was unintentional, or I don't know how exactly you would phrase it, but I would just want to make sure that it's not something that's done, not that this department would be releasing information that just, ruin somebody, just to make sure that that can't be one of the, that couldn't be a charge later on.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly Taylor, the question about civil liability really, from what I remember the Attorney General telling us is that all of this process, the employer, the consortium, the drug testing, is outside of our control. And yet we're putting it on our record and then releasing it. And so that exposes us to great risk for liability for something happening that was wrong, or the test results being wrong or mishandled, and they call it the chain of custody of, the body fluids and all of that. And so this is an attempt to try to mitigate that huge exposure to liability. Just because everything's outside of our control. We're just like the last person getting some stuff to put on the record.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit confused, Ms. Robinson. Are the dash ones, you believe, may have some constitutional problems, but the dash twos don't because of the notary?
Not because of the notary thing, because of the permission.
Permission.
If there is a constitutional problem with the dash one amendment, it would be, I believe, a right to privacy issue, because the results of a drug test could be considered medical information or things like that. As I said, I don't know that it would be found unconstitutional. But if it is, to the extent that there's a constitutional problem, it's solved by requiring the person to give permission before the information can be released, because you can always give permission for any private information about yourself.
And if you want to be hired, you would have to give permission.
Sure. So, I would.
Yeah.
I'm going to move building, sure. Well, we have, my question is the constitutional problem. The constitutional problem for the benefit of the committee is not counting to six. It's a real constitutional problem this time, I think. But we have the Attorney General saying one thing and our legal counsel almost agreeing with the Attorney General. I don't want to put you on the spot. I'll say that in the totally wrong phrase, but I don't want to move an illegal bill out of committee. I don't mind moving an almost illegal bill out of committee.
The most I can tell you is that it's a risk, but I don't know how big the risk is.
I'm prepared to take the risk as chairman of this committee to save one life. If that's all it says, I'll be very happy. And if I have to take some heat for it, I don't mind that a bit. So if the committee would desire We have two amendments before us. Is there any further comments here? I know there's a cost factor. It will have to go to Ways and Means, by the way, so we won't be taking it to the floor. And we can talk about it some more if that's the comfort level for the committee. Janet, I had a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Either for Kelly, from what you talked to with the Department of Justice, or for Joan, the hearings requirement seems to be a pretty big part of the expense for allowing hearings, requests for a hearing. Is how important is that in a constitutional question for due process?
That's very important. Another constitutional problem with the original bill that was raised by the Department of Justice, I think, correctly, is due process, and the hearing would avoid any due process problem. I think it would be riskier to move the bill without the hearing than it is to move it on a private scale without the permission.
I have no problem saving a life for $250,000, $2 million, $20 million, and we're talking of sending our young men and women over to Kosovo right now, and I'm afraid to send them down I-5 sometimes. That'd be safer than Kosovo. Nothing against the trucking industry, gentlemen, not at all, but it's some of the drivers out there in both industries, city cars as well, I wish you could do that. Is there any other discussion from the committee?
Then
we're going into work session. Thank you all very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3292. We'll open the work session on House Bill 3292. We have two amendments before us, Badge 2, which has the notary Senate. Is that correct, Senate?
Mr. Chair, the Dash 2s have everything that the Dash 1s have, and plus the requirement for permission and the notary. The notary section could be taken out conceptually from the Dash 2.
I would like to suggest that if we're interested in the Dash 2, to take the notary out, but still have the written permission.
Mr. Chair, you know, I serve on the Judiciary Committee. I actually, on my notes, started to write to this. I was in that committee. That is a big, important part for me. I really think to remain true to the Constitution and people's rights privacy, we do need to allow for permission. I'd be interested in taking out the notary provision, but I don't think I could support this bill unless we have the permission granted, and certainly an employer can say, well, if you don't provide me with the permission, then we won't hire you. I know the truckers don't like that, and that's a problem, but I also have to look at protecting our constitutional rights. So that's where I'm at. I support that.
Mr. Chair, I should have asked this question of the department, but my understanding is an employment side of your record and a non-employment side. We're only talking about tests that were positive. What on the employment side, it seems to me that the public interest is well served by having that be available. I'm glad our attorney got that, but we're wrestling with which of these amendments, and I'd be happy to move the Dash 2 with the division of the notary requirement, just for the sake of...
Well, I thank you. I'll accept that as a motion. Representative Taylor moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3292. With the elimination of the section, Janet, you know what you're talking about?
Yes, it's the end of Section 9, Mr. Chair. The written permission must be notarized would be taken out.
Thank you. Everyone understands the motion?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none, I suppose we need to call the roll. Brad, real quick, if you could, please.
Representative
Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Cross. Aye.
Representative Wiener.
Aye.
Representative Loken. Representative
Taylor. Aye.
Representative
Walker.
Aye.
Representative Lowe.
Yes.
Aye. We've moved the Dash 2 amendments. Now we have the fourth Dash 1 amendment. That takes everything. Thank you very much for the help. It's getting late. We have House Bill 3292 amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3292 is amended through the Ways and Means.
Thank you very much, Mr. Taylor. Reverend Taylor moves House Bill 3292 as amended to the Ways and Means of the Repass recommendation. Thank you very much. Is there any discussion? Thank you. The none, the hearing none, with the clerk call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Joan Robinson, very much for your advice. We appreciate it. We move House Bill 3392 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee of the DUPAT recommendation. Hearing and thank you, committee, very much for your patience. I will be going Friday. You'll have to put up Representative Layman Friday. And then on Monday, I believe we have another chairman called Representative
Friday,
Walker.
Friday,
I'll be here Monday.
Friday, then move the shed bill.
Is that it? Yeah, bill is not on the agenda.
We got a gut and stuff, though. We got a relationship.